I look back on how I was before the fortress that doesn't exist. Frame her disguise from one that hurts to one that is loved, held in her own arms. Inside there is a heart that must be found. She must be found by only herself. If I'm her, then she's never alone. I hear her
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. There's been further turmoil on Wall Street as uncertainty continues among investors over US trade policy. The fall contrasts with the huge gains made on Wednesday in response to Donald Trump reversing his decision to impose many tariffs on countries other than China. Our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore, explains why the markets are still volatile.
That's a reaction to the sizable tariffs that remain in place on U.S. imports from China. That stands at 145%, 20% the administration has said is in response to China's handling of the fentanyl crisis, and an additional 125% put into effect yesterday. Now, that makes investors uneasy, and we're seeing it play out on Wall Street. The Dow is down nearly 1,700 points as we speak. That's down 4.14%. The S&P down closer to 5%. The NASDAQ down more than 5%. In fact, about 5.75%. But put it into context with what we've seen the last week, and the S&P, that broad 500 company index, is broadly down.
Meanwhile, China has insisted it won't give in to pressure from President Trump over tariffs, but says it's willing to negotiate. The Commerce Ministry spokeswoman, He Yongqiang, said respectful dialogue is possible, but that it's still prepared to fight to the end.
The position of the Chinese side is clear and consistent. The door to dialogue is open, but it must be based on mutual respect and conducted in an equal manner. If the U.S. chooses to engage in confrontation, China will fight to the end. Pressure, threats, and blackmail are not the correct way to engage with China.
Israel's defense minister has said a southern so-called buffer zone in South Gaza is to be expanded to include the city of Rafah. Israel Katz said the move was intended to increase military pressure on Hamas to release the remaining hostages. Gary O'Donoghue reports from Jerusalem.
Israel has already deployed troops to a new security corridor known as the Morag Corridor, cutting off Rafah from the rest of the strip. But it now appears the intention is to further expand the military security zone in the south as well. That could, in effect, turn Gaza into an enclave within Israeli-controlled territory, reducing the size of Gaza by a further 20%. Military analysts suggest there's a plan to push civilians towards the coast so the Israeli army can focus on eliminating Hamas in the urban areas.
Indonesia says it's willing to temporarily take in 1,000 Palestinians affected by the war in Gaza. The Muslim-majority country said it would accept the wounded, traumatised and those orphaned by Israel's invasion and bombing. But Indonesia says it doesn't support the permanent relocation of Palestinians from Gaza. BBC News. A general strike against public spending cuts in Argentina has severely disrupted transport. All domestic flights have been cancelled, trains and metro services have been suspended in Buenos Aires and other parts of the country. Many shops have remained closed in the capital, but buses continued to work. It's the third general strike called by Argentina's powerful union confederations since President Javier Milei took office at the end of 2023. Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, has been charged with treason at a court in Dar es Salaam. He was arrested on Wednesday after a rally, one of several in recent weeks, in which he'd called for electoral reform. A fertility clinic in Australia has apologised to a woman who unknowingly gave birth to a stranger's baby. A mix-up by the firm Monash IVF meant another patient's embryo was accidentally implanted into the mother. The mistake only came to light some time after the baby was born. The clinic has blamed human error and says it's truly sorry. Dozens of human skeletons have been found by builders installing new water pipes and tram tracks through the centre of the Belgian capital, Brussels. They're believed to be part of a 13th century graveyard for the city's poorest citizens. Nikki Cardwell reports.
It's unlikely that the thousands of tourists that walk every year from the Palais Royal de Bruxelles to the Palais de Justice have any idea about what lies beneath the cobbles of the Rue de la Régence in the heart of the city. Neither, it seems, did the workmen who found at least 30 bodies as they dug trenches for new pipes. A full excavation is now being carried out and the bones are being exhumed. Archaeologists say it's unusual for such a large number of skeletons to be found in the middle of a city, and their discovery will provide a unique insight into life in medieval Brussels.
That's the latest. BBC News.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and co-workers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Today we'll be exploring the issues surrounding moves currently underway to challenge and do away with birthright citizenship. That is, the right of U.S. citizenship bestowed upon anyone born in the United States as guaranteed under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Joining us online from Milwaukee, where she teaches at the UWM, is the author, organizer, and historian of migration and immigrant rights movements, Rachel Buff, an immigrants' rights activist. Her published works include A is for Asylum Seeker, Words for People on the Move, Against the Deportation Terror, Organizing for Immigrant Rights in the 20th Century, and an edited volume titled Immigrant Rights in the Shadow of Citizenship. Rachel Buff also frequently writes for various popular publications and has been the faculty editor for the American Association of University Professors Journal of Academic Freedom. She also has served as a member of the Academic Advisory Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. Today we'll be drawing from her March 27th Progressive Magazine online article that focused on the issues regarding deported asylum seekers who gave birth in the United States and the increasingly grim reality for those children born to non-citizens here in the U.S. Rachel Buff, welcome to A Public Affair in WORT.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel, let's begin by providing our listeners some background. The immediate story tails back to the final months, of the first Trump administration, when several pregnant asylum seekers who crossed the U.S. border in search of medical facilities. Recount what happened to them.
So just to give a little broader context, we had Title 42 in effect, which was the Trump administration's reach back to a 1940 public health law and use it to say no one can cross the border. This combined with the what were called the migrant protection protocols, but advocates call it the Remain in Mexico policy, meant that people from all over the world who had come at great cost, financial, personal, you know, just athletic walking across countries, people who come from all over the world to border cities like Juarez and Tijuana were stuck there. And, you know, in those cities, there were, you know, mixed attitudes towards hosting these non-Mexican folks. Xenophobia is not a uniquely American phenomenon. And there certainly were not enough services for them. You know, there were shelters. I've spent some time in Tijuana with Al Otro Lado, which is a migrant rights and legal organization that is involved in this story. And I can say that, you know, I did see shelters. There are shelters, there are relief efforts, but there were thousands of people at the time, as I'm sure there are now, who are basically living on the streets or partially in a shelter, but, you know, that didn't really cover all their needs. So in this context, with people not being allowed to cross and being forced to remain in, you know, where they had gotten to, and it's important to say there, just to give you a broad context of what this looked and felt like at the time, that people, particularly from the Americas, particularly from Central America, for example, from Honduras, who had fled intense gang violence, you know, people who had left after being threatened or even having a family member murdered, very, very common, and who had experienced extortion, kidnapping, rape in their home country and on the very treacherous journey from their home country, were vulnerable to those same people. The thing about the drug syndicates and gangs is they're pretty sophisticated. So if you were fleeing them and living on the street, it was not hard often for them to find you or for some other ill-intentioned interlocutors to find you. So in other words, very dangerous. You know, if we go back to the United Nations High Council on Refugees Proclamation of 1951, if you go read that, I always make my students read it because it's very lovely. And it says, displaced people, asylum seekers, have rights. They have right to education. They have a right to housing. They have a right to work. They have a right to travel documents. None of this was being observed or is being observed. So you have these people living on the streets or living precariously in shelters or staying, you know, in a one-room apartment with tons of other people. And during this time, in desperation for medical attention, several very pregnant, 9-month pregnant women decided, you know, and this is independently, but, you know, they became a collective group because of the legal action that was subsequently pursued. Women decided with a family member or alone to try and risk crossing, to surrender themselves to the border patrol in the hopes that this would allow them to be taken in for medical treatment. And several of these women did this and wound up giving birth to their children in U.S. hospitals. And, you know, the current effort to get rid of birthright citizenship was just a sparkle in the eye of the regime at that point, right? They're thinking about it, but they haven't had the 4 years to study. Like, the Biden administration basically a study break for these people, right? And they did a deep dive legally. You can see it. There was a lot of studying about how to do this that we see in many of the really violent things being used against immigrants, the weaponization of the McCarran-Walter Act, for example, to argue that anyone who doesn't like U.S. foreign policy should be deported, the use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. They hadn't studied that much, but they, you know, so the sense from everyone from the Border Patrol, from the hospital staff, not necessarily the hospital staff, but from the Border Patrol on up, was there was a problem, right? Which is that these women who were in the country illegally, though as asylum seekers, they do have the internationally certified right to enter the country, but that was not being attended to, had given birth to U.S. citizen children. And this is the big problem for those that have long opposed the idea of birthright citizenship, which, just quick review, the 14th Amendment is one of the Reconstruction Amendments. And, you know, the Reconstruction Amendments had the job of solving the problem of having an enslaved class of people with no rights. So the 14th Amendment, in trying to remedy that, you know, and it's 13, 14, and 15, 14th Amendment specifically said everyone, and this is important for me to say on the radio, everyone in the country, regardless of their immigration status, has the right to due process. Everyone, everyone, everyone. Is it being observed? No. But the 14th Amendment said everyone has it. And then the 14th Amendment in it, the Citizenship Clause went on to say everyone born in the United States is a citizen, right? This is a problem we have with settler colonial nations, right? The only people who can say that they're deeply from here are indigenous folks. So settler colonial nations have to resolve that, like who gets to be part of us. The 14th Amendment did that, as has become more popular to talk about recently. Subsequently, the very important Supreme Court jurisprudence in 1898 took the case of Wong Kim Ark, a Chinese American who had been born in San Francisco, returned to China. While he was in China, they passed the Chinese exclusion law. And, you know, Wong Kim Ark knew what was up, took pictures of his documents, got certified receipts from neighbors saying, yeah, I knew this guy, I knew his mom, he's been here, you know, he was born here, came back into the country with those documents, and they said, you know, no, you're not, you're Chinese, we can't let you in. And he said, no, I'm American. This eventually goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, agonizingly, nine white guys, right, you know, and they really don't want to think like, oh my God, this Chinese guy can be an American, but it's close enough to the Civil War and the splitting of the court over a really related case of Dred Scott and his family about whether they had citizenship rights. So agonizingly, the Supreme Court decides in Wong Kim Ark's favor, like, yes, you're a citizen. If you're born here, you're a citizen. So I was sort of haunted by the Title 42 moms. I did some work remotely during the pandemic in their behalf. There was a whole international team because eventually Alachulato was able to sue for. So anyway, these women leave the hospital and they're not given documentations of their children's status. Their children are now citizens, right? So they're sort of, they're thrown out of the hospital often a day or two or less than a day, you know, really still needing postnatal care with their now citizen infants. And they're thrown back, you know, they're deported back across the border. Where, again, there are no services for them and there are no services for their new citizen infants that they have to take care of. Eventually, Alachulato sues for their documents under the Freedom of Information Act, and so they can document the rights of their children. And also, Alachulato is eventually able, under a lawsuit called the Huisha Huisha suit, to argue that some, not all, but a small number of the people stuck at the border who are asylum seekers can come in while, this is how international policy is supposed to work. You're supposed to get to come in, say, I fear persecution if returned to my country of origin. And the immigration director is supposed to say, okay, you're going to get your hearing and you can be here and you can have a work permit and everything. You can live here like a, you know, like a person until we hear your case. And if it's decided in favor, then you get to stay. And if not, you'll have to go. We don't do that anymore. Whole other story. But Alachulato and some other orgs, the Haitian Bridge, the ACLU, are able to sue for some of these women to come into the country. So I found out about this when we were working, a group of us remotely during the pandemic, trying to make sure that the women and their children, and we're talking sometimes 17-year-olds with their infants, have some support, are able to get their documents, are able to apply for asylum status. You know, some of them relocated to be near family. Others of them, I worked with this one woman who was living in a apartment with a man she'd never met in Texarkana, Arkansas, and didn't speak the language. You know, so a lot of them just wind up here. So anyway, that's how I got to know about these stories and listening. And suddenly this feels like a long time ago, Alan, when I was freaking out about birthright citizenship, because there's been so much else to freak out about in the interim. When I was thinking about it, I kept thinking about the Title 42 moms and this idea that, like, you know, a person who, you know, because they're undocumented, we have culturally decided doesn't belong here, doesn't have rights to prenatal care, doesn't have rights to stay in the hospital until she's able to leave and be and not be bleeding literally in some cases anymore, and then the fate of her children. Like, and I started thinking of the Title 42 moms and the deportations and the violence of this being that's what it's going to be like if, you know, if they're able, in fact, to abolish birthright citizenship. So sorry, that's a really long answer to a pretty short question.
I threw you a softball pitch. The title 42 of the U.S. Code was part of a 1944 public health law.
Yeah.
How does that morph into what you're talking about? That is, understandably, at some level, during the in March of 2020, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, it's taken up by the Department of Homeland Security and morphs into something far greater than it was meant to.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think a parallel is, you know, so the Title 42 in 1944 was supposed to be, you know, extraordinary cases. And, you know, like a lot of things, this is repeated a lot in a lot of places in immigration law. If you come into the country with a contagious disease, you're not going to be allowed in, right? That's just, you don't even need a special policy for that. But, you know, Title 42, and I think we are dealing then and now with an administration that studies the cracks in our legal system, right? And looks for like old things to interpret badly and resurrect. I call them zombie laws. So Title 42 was supposed to be small, right? Like, okay, this family seems to have scarlet fever. Maybe we shouldn't let them in. You know, like, you know, we can put a hold on this. But it was used to basically refortify the U.S.-Mexico border and not let anyone in, which was obviously an endpoint that they were pursuing anyway. A related example is like the rationalization of detaining for deportation people like Mahmoud Khalil, Mamadou Tal, is this weird repurposing of the McCarran-Walter law of 1952, which said, you know, we don't want, you know, we can decide to deport people who are working against our foreign policy. And what that meant is if the ambassador is over here fomenting revolution, you can throw him out. It didn't mean like, you know, random student being pro-Palestine gets to go. But, you know, we have, you know, with Project 25 and the wealth supporting that think tank, the Heritage Foundation, these people are doing deep dives and kind of badly reinterpreting bad law. Like McCarran-Walter shouldn't even be on the books anymore for my money. Like I'm sort of shocked that it still is available to be repurposed. And it never, ever meant that. Like even in the depths of the Cold War, even the depths of McCarthyism, they didn't go that far. But these guys are taking like these little weird unknown provisions and reanimating them into like terrible, scary zombie policy.
So let's get into the challenge to birthright citizenship underway at various levels. Tell us about the forces, some of the key organizations and or proponents of this offensive.
Well, it should be said, I've long challenged my graduate students. Somebody should write a history of trying to get rid of birthright citizenship and started in 1975 because somebody has always been against it. I honestly think some of the Supreme Court justices who voted for it were like, ugh. Because essentially the 14th Amendment, and particularly after Wong Kim Ark in 1898, that is the door to say we now have Asian American, Chinese American, you know, whatever, communities, and they're Americans. There are a lot of people throughout history. You know, you can think about America First people in the around World War I. You can, you know, like all of those sort of racialized, xenophobic movements, the KKK. You know, nobody, you know, those folks have long, this is a holy grail for the racist right. You know, the notion that, you know, we, you know, if you think about people who are influenced by replacement theory, for example, which says that Jews are trying to bring in foreigners and people of color to replace, you know, Northern European white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and make the country bad. And, you know, the trope of making America great again is about cleaning that out, right? So rethinking that, you know, the gunman who shot up the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh did so because he had heard, he was obsessed with Central American asylum seekers, you know, again, polluting the country, taking over. And he had heard that the HIAS, the Venerable Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, was meeting in the Tree of Life. And it inflamed him because it seemed to him like exactly what those folks fear. Like, see, the Jews are like helping the refugees and they're besmirching our country, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a long-standing thing. You know, that we, you know, we have, you know, it's one of the central, I would say it's an American contradiction about citizenship. We're a settler colonial nation. Really, none of us belong here. But we have to figure out who gets to be a member. And the birthright citizenship is one of the ways we set policy. Now, there's a formidable architecture now on the right of xenophobic groups like a Center for Immigration Studies, which I started my career, I applied for a fellowship there. I was like, I'm studying immigration. This seems really good. Well, they're a hate organization, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And they, you know, they're constantly proposing more and more exclusive policy. So there's a whole cadre about them. And I would have said, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, they seemed a little bit like wing nuts when I learned about who they are, but they have become very central in the constellation of the far right that now rules our country, right? So you can now say things like, you know, when I was imagining to the grad students, nobody ever took me up on this, but it was a good project, you know, study the history of this. You know, you're going to find some wild people. You're going to find some really interesting connections and continuities between right-wing formations. But I was kind of imagining it like this is a history of, you know, far-right xenophobia and its influence on the United States. But it's now mainstream. Right? It's now like people can say. And, you know, the thing is, Alan, and so I'm going to ask you a question. What I don't understand as a third generation Jewish American is like, if that goes, am I a citizen? Like, how far is it going? Like, if my grandma wasn't a citizen, so then my mom, I don't know. Like, and I'm not, you know, as much as this is a holy grail of certain portions of the far right, with a lot of this, they have figured out like these very flimsy justifications for some brutal policy targeting vulnerable immigrants, targeting immigration advocates. They figured out how to do that, but I don't know that they figured out what all this means. Who exactly is a citizen? How do we decide who's a citizen if we lose birthright citizenship? Like, have they thought that one through? I have heard no, like, well, but, you know, these people will be and these people won't be and you'll have to fill out a form. Like, it doesn't seem like they have really thought about that, because that is not what they care about. They care about terror. They care about making America great again, which is always about white supremacy. They don't really care to think through, like, who gets to stay. I asked my immigration history class, like, how many of you have parents who weren't born here? And about half of them did. And I was like, I have no idea what. And it also, I think, testifies to another really important thing to say right now. Right now, we're witnessing just this terrible brutality against the foreign-born. But historically, everything they do to a targeted minority, they eventually do or try to do to everyone. So, you know, Trump has already said, with the deportations to Sikot in El Salvador, this huge maximum security, essentially prison enslavement system, he has already floated, and these people float nothing by accident, right? He's already floated that that might happen to American citizens. So adding to the horror of living in this times is watching them model stuff on the most vulnerable among us, you know, to, you know, that is going to, that easily could become mainstream.
You're listening to Rachel Buff, historian and specializing really in migrant rights, immigration rights, and the current mood quite clearly. 608-256-2001, if you want to join us with a question, a comment, an observation. Rachel's will be leaving us before the end of the hour, so get in your calls now, folks, if you want to participate today. Again, 608-256-2001. Rachel Buff, tell us about John Eastman.
So John Eastman is a far, is a far-right operative. He has been a professor at the Claremont Law School, which is a center of far-right thinking. He was one of the innovators of the big steal theory that, you know, Trump had really won the election and the rest of us stole it from him. It's important to say, I was just thinking about this because I was writing a lecture about Central American immigration in the 1970s and 80s, that along with zombie public policy, we have zombie public operatives. You know, if we think about, you know, somebody like John Eastman, who has now been disbarred, but I expect him to be pardoned and rebarred any minute, the way things are going. People like Eastman, like Elliot Abrams, who was kind of Reagan's guy carrying out really disastrous and oppressive policies during the dirty wars in El Salvador and U.S.-backed support for the Contras in Nicaragua. Rudy Giuliani, an architect of Haitian detention, which grows into our current private system. Like these people, like they seem to have very long political careers. And so all kinds of like terror in their wake, you know, and so I think like when we think about how many pardons have been granted since January 20th, you know, there are people who haven't been pardoned that, you know, probably, you know, should have been imprisoned. Somebody like John Eastman is an eccentric, a radical, and, you know, he's been floating these ideas. And, you know, I will say of these folks that they're very creative, you know, and again, they had the four-year study break of the Biden administration. And to be fair, Biden still used Title 42 and did not, you know, there were ways that Biden could have come in. You know, it would have been very popular because there was a lot of outcry about the Trump one policy, particularly at the U.S.-Mexico border. If you remember the huge protests around the country about family separation in 2018, it would have been a very popular thing for the Democrats to say they're inhumane and we're going to fix it. But they kind of didn't do that. I mean, you saw that with Harris, right, in the campaign this summer and fall, listening to the right on immigration, because I don't know why. I'm not a political advisor, but it seems to me that driving around the country in 2018, 2019, average people living far from the border were really appalled when news about family separation, and to the extent that people know about the Title 42 moms, they tend not to. When people hear that story, 17-year-old young woman just given birth, day after deported, bleeding with her baby, you know, most people are like, yeah, that's really bad, right? So Biden could have done us the favor of fixing some of those things for political reason. He didn't. We saw a lot of Democrats vote for the disastrous Lake and Riley Act at the end of the Biden term, which was not opposed by the party. And really, again, we could make better policy and political capital if the Democrats were to attend what I think most Americans think of as humane. But in any case, we are kind of left with the results of the scary four-year study hall, where these folks have just been looking for, when I kept telling graduate students to write about this, I did not imagine that it would become a political reality. I thought it would be a study, in xenophobia and the right, but it is now mainstream. And with this Supreme Court that has signed off on terrible interpretation of the Alien Enemies Act, terrible interpretations of the terrible McCarran-Walter Act, you know, who knows what's going to pass muster there.
In your piece, you mentioned that in August 2020, Newsweek magazine published an op-ed by Eastman questioning the 2020 vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris's eligibility for the office. Talk about that. He asserted that she could not be a citizen.
Well, I'm a New Yorker, right? And so I remember Trump, you know, calling for the lynching of the Central Park Five, right? Young African-American men falsely accused, as it turns out, of raping a white woman in Central Park. And then I remember Trump rattling on about Barack Hussein Obama is not a citizen. And again, you know, in retrospect, I was like, yeah, this is terrible and wrong. And I know that, you know, but what happened there is you generate this sort of frenzy around birthers, right? Who are like, you know, they're, you know, and there it's kind of like he's still standing with birthright citizenship. He's just saying, you know, all these people are faking it. It's kind of like the stuff about election fraud, which, you know, there's maybe 200 incidences of that across the country ever. And in the reading I've done, more than half of it is on, you know, is on the right. It is not statistically, it's not statistically anything, election fraud. It's not statistically anything, you know, Barack Obama born in Hawaii, which because of the history and colonization and everything else is in fact the United States. He is a birthright citizen, but you gin up this frenzy and fear, right? And the sense that like the other side is illegitimate, that immigrants are faking. The Lake and Riley Act, named for a victim of a terrible crime perpetrated by an undocumented man. Nonetheless, undocumented immigrants, all immigrants commit crimes at far lower rates than native-born people. But you know, like you name an act like that, you honor the survivors of, you know, one random terrible act, you know, and then you know, it's what we're seeing in a terrifying way, I think, is people's crazy racist fantasies being summoned into being policy.
On President Trump's first day back in office, his administration published a proclamation which asserted that migrants are part of an invading force. Talk about that. You know, it almost harkens back to Cold War fantasy, science fiction invaders from outer space and so on.
Well, you know, it's, you know, the alien, you know, using that term also puts us in 50s science fiction territory. And if some, and this is the Alien Enemies Act, right? The Alien Enemies Act says when you're at war, you know, and at the time the fear was about France or Britain, when there are agents of a foreign power that we're at war with here, you can deport them, right? It's a diplomatic, it's a law about diplomacy. Right. And you know, this is sort of a neglected thing. A lot of our immigration laws, McCarran Walter has a whole thing about when an American GI is abroad, but, you know, he and his partner have a baby. What are the rights of that, you know, baby that's born on an American ship? Because they're thinking about, you know, war and occupation and all the things. Right. But so what we see here is that that proclamation, which I've looked a lot at because it keeps coming up in my class, I've been to the border. I've seen what the people coming out of the caravans look like. They do not look like they're prepared for conflict. They are not wearing uniforms. They are not mostly carrying weapons. They are mostly carrying babies and each other and the few things they could grab before they fled their homelands, which had been made unlivable mostly by United States foreign policy. To call those people an invading army is a mockery. However, and this is one of the main practices that Trump learned from Roger Stone, who learned it from Roy Cohn, right? Advisor to McCarthy. Just keep saying it. Don't abandon that, right? It's an invading army. They're invading. And at a certain point, you know, it gets picked up by people. It gets talked about seriously. This is an idea that has no currency. You know, if anybody who has eyes and who's ever seen a human knows that these are not invaders, but if they're cast as invaders, and you know, this fits into the MAGA framework and the replacement theory framework, they're people who are being brought here to get rid of our country, you know, which fits into all kinds of crazy racist stuff. It fits into crazy anti-Semitic stuff, which is like Jews, we're always like trying to do something behind the scenes. That's how we do. You know, it gets some currency. And what we're seeing now, and, you know, I think there's a lot of, I've read a lot of things about sort of preemptive cooperation with authoritarianism. What we're seeing in some areas of the media, both legacy and online, is like, so that word invasion is less ridiculous than it should be. You know, it becomes like, well, you know, it's accepted in some parts of the media. It's accepted on Fox. There's an invasion, right? You know, this tortures the language. That's not what invasion is. Eagle Pass, Texas, where you have impoverished people fleeing danger on one side and ribbon wire in the water that they might try to swim across and buoys coated with ribbon wire and people with guns on the U.S. side. This is not that is not an invasion. That's what Greg Abbott wants you to think, because it makes Greg Abbott look heroic. But you know, as somebody who loves words, this is really complicated, right? That's not what invasion means. Yes, there are a lot of them, and you know, clearly there's a lot of people in power right now who don't like them, but they are not invading our country in any. But you know, once you have that in the discourse, and you put it in the proclamation, and then it's sort of like infiltrates the law. That's what we're seeing.
Talking about words, talk about this thing formerly known as the Migrant Protection Protocols. That is, it's also referred to as the Remain in Mexico policy.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that this morning. I was thinking particularly about the outsourcing of deportees to Bukele's terrifying jails, and thinking, like, you know, the way that policy is being made right now, the restoration of the so-called migrant protection or Remain in Mexico policy, I was thinking, like, as an American, like, I know our democracy doesn't work as well as we'd like it. I know it's, you know, we don't have as much say, but like, there was nowhere that anyone like you or me or any of our listeners could have written to our congressperson, or, you know, like, there's no one to call because everything is being done by fiat. So the restoration of the so-called migrant protection protocols are part of a broader effort to, like, if asylum policy rests on the asylum seeker puts one foot in the country and says, I need asylum, and then they have certain rights, even though we haven't been, you know, taking those seriously, oh, at least since 1980, if not before, we don't even want them to come, right? And so what happened in the first Trump administration is people would come in and be detained and separated from their families. That is not in the international law. There is no reason for that. None of these people are criminals. I mean, you know, probably in the population, just in any statistical population, there are criminals. But, you know, most of them are law-abiding people who fled their homes. Right? Why did we have to take their outerwear and their children and imprison them in hileras, which are 55 degrees? Not really clear. But Remain in Mexico is part of this initiative to not even let them get across. And now we're seeing all these third country agreements. And, you know, something our current ruler is good at is twisting the arms of foreign governments. So places like, you know, all throughout Latin America, we have these agreements, like, let's just, you know, keep them there. Keep them somewhere else. You know, is there any guarantee that their conditions will be good? The Remain in Mexico policy pretty much guaranteed poverty, vulnerability, and disease. So, you know, keeping them, you know, the countries that have been coerced into accepting deportation flights, like Guatemala, for example, you know, there wasn't an agreement about what rights the people would have, or would they get a sandwich on the plane, or, you know, where are they going to get to live? None of that. Just like, we don't want them here, which is not humanitarian, and also not very far-seeing policy.
608, we have Rachel Buff with us for another few minutes. If you want to get in with a call, a comment, your concerns, give us a call at 608-256-2001. I want to come back to the 14th Amendment. You touched on it before, but I think it's important because there's two things going on here. In addition to the birthright citizenship, the 14th Amendment guarantees due process to everyone in the United States, including non-citizens. The due process rights of non-citizens have been reaffirmed in immigration law. There's a lot of cases and so on. Talk about that. That is this, well, the irony, really, that this was one of the radical Reconstruction amendments, and that there are people looking to just basically gut that amendment. Talk about that.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that pulse beat of white supremacy that runs all the way back and runs the arc of our history.
Yeah, when the court splits over Dred Scott, the dissenting justice from Massachusetts says in his dissent, we cannot have a system where there's a class of people that doesn't have access to rights. We cannot. You know, and this is before the Civil War. So the 14th Amendment had to heal that, right? How can, you know, what can we do? And so very, you know, in a way, it's a very visionary and lovely, you know, it's radical Reconstruction. It's probably the far arc of racial justice in the 19th century in this country, at least federal racial justice. You know, they go together and they're both under siege. On Fox News, for example, it's fairly common for commentators to float, well, not everyone should have due process. We don't have time for that, right? And that's what we're seeing. The deportation flights of so-called Venezuelans, member of Trendagua, right? They're not getting any due process. And even the court that said, okay, it's okay to deport those folks, but they need time. That is a reaffirmation of the due process stuff. And it'll be very interesting to track this because I do think that's a coming front. Like, no, not due process for everyone. And the argument will be, you know, we've already seen some deputization of Border Patrol agents. So, you know, our immigration courts are clogged. There aren't enough of them. There's a lot of people. So the idea that a Border Patrol agent, who's a very different operator, right, than an immigration judge, different education, different disposition, some of them are nice, some of them are not, you know, they're people, right, that a Border Patrol agent can hear your asylum case. That is a very different due process. And that's already happened. That's already happening. But I think we're going to see, like, one of the fronts we're going to see, because this administration is in a hurry to get rid of a class of people. It's what it promised when it was running for office, and it's what it wants to deliver. And brutality is the brand, right? We're all supposed to be completely shocked and terrorized by this. Immigrants, foreign-born communities, people born here are supposed to be. There are reports from all over the country of children not being in school, of businesses not being patronized, of restaurants being empty, of, you know, there was a deportation in Milwaukee 2 days ago of two people who were at City Hall, or a lovely City Hall, the Zeidler Municipal Building, being deported, just trying to go about their lives, pay their taxes, pay their parking fees, right? You know, once you terrorize that and take away anyone's right to contest it, we're at totalitarianism. And that is the project.
608. We had Rachel's with us for another 3 minutes, less than 3 minutes. But if you want to get in with a call, a comment, an observation, give us a call. 608-256-2001. In a sense, the people that you're talking about here today, the moms and the kids, are like, in some sense, the canaries in the mine, mm-hmm. right? And it appears more and more to me, and to many of our listeners, I assume, that the oxygen level is getting lower and lower society-wide. As you alluded to, once you can do it to one group, others become more vulnerable. Some parting words, something, as I know we got to let you go, but summing up some?
I guess I want to say, like, I've used the word terror and been pretty critical. But I do want to say, you know, as somebody who studies the history of immigrant advocacy, so both advocacy by and for the foreign-born, because there are some of us who are native-born that see this and relate to it. We have seen, you know, certainly since 2006, and I would argue since, you know, the 1930s, heroic advocacy on the part of foreign-born communities, on the part of immigrant rights organizers. We have seen interracial, inter-ethnic organizing for these rights. So in that way, I'm really hopeful. Just here in Milwaukee, I could name you 4 or 5 groups of folks that are working on protecting our foreign-born neighbors, that are coalitions of immigrants and native-born folks. So I think things are really dire and bleak, and we need to organize, and this is the moment. You know, I wrote about the Title 42 moms because I think there are a lot of people who are in similarly impossible circumstance. The Title 42 moms for me was an eruption. Like, I got to see, just because Alla Trillato did such amazing work representing and making them visible. I think there are a lot of people whose lives are complicated and in similarly dire ways to these young women, the Title 42 moms. But we also see heroic advocacy by immigrants and by their allies. You know, that what Alla Trillato manages to do to bring it to light, what the Haitian Bridge, I think about League Alert of ACLU, like we have champions and we have to be champions.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time today and the work you've been doing. You've been listening to Rachel Buff. She's an immigrant. I'm going to get this right today yet, folks. An immigrants rights activist, teaches at the UW-Milwaukee, is an author, organizer, and historian of immigrant rights movements. Thank you ever so much, and keep on keeping on, Rachel Buff.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you for having me. Thank you for reading my stuff. I hope to see you again.
Bye-bye. We have a few minutes left in the hour, so, and we can open up the phone line, so open up, turn this into an impromptu open mic. What are you thinking about this hour? Did our guest stimulate any thoughts? 608-256-2001. Again, if you want to join us with a question, a comment, an observation, I'd like suggestions from you folks as to, for guests perhaps, or topics that I don't usually get to. We do have a caller on the line, Jack, our engineer tells me. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Alan?
Yes.
I'm sorry I missed your guest. My question is, how have the Trump people managed to, you know, divorce, insulate, silo, you know, their obviously racist policies on immigration from the economic reality is of, you know, people we need to work in the economy? And I'll hang up.
Hold on a second. I'm not sure about your question. Is he gone, Jack? Well, yeah. Call back if you get a chance, caller. And I wasn't sure about what you were asking. 608-256-2001. Again, we have a few minutes left. Boy, I'm having trouble with my tongue today. We have a few minutes left in the hour. I see now that the caller, Michael, was asking about Trump's racist policies and how they, in a sense, get separated out, from the economic issues of our moment. I think that's right. I don't have an answer for it, really, except, of course, that we live in a culture that is compartmentalized, constantly, single issue, and so on. But race and economics have always been intertwined. There's no doubt about that, as is the question of who does the jobs that, you know, in so many of them, in so many areas of the economy, but migrant labor. So 608-256-2001. Again, I'm taking ad hoc calls regarding, what would you like to hear about? Who should I have on as guests? I've been trying to, excuse me. I've been trying to have on people that are of interest, and we've had good response to a number of people that I hope to have back. But who are we missing here? 608-256-2001. Jack, you're telling me we have someone maybe? Yes? Yeah. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Do we have him? Oh, I'm getting a hand. Hold on a second. Jack tells me from behind the glass. But we do have a caller that wants to come on with something. Go ahead. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about the use of the word ruler for our current leader. I think most of the Trump voters thought they were electing a president to function as head of our government within our established system. But instead, it turns out that the individual in question had in mind that he would be a ruler and that he has a mandate to do that. And I think we're in deep trouble because of that. I think it's time for all of us to insist to our congresspeople that it's their turn to stand up and do the things that they were elected to do, because they were not elected to be doormats. So we don't need a ruler, and we don't need doormats bowing down before the ruler. That's my comment. Thanks.
Well, I think that's a sentiment that is widely, in different fashion, widely felt and understood. The increasing, our guest used the word totalitarian, the authoritarian nature, the, I'll use the F word on the air, the fascistic nature of the certain elements in the current administration is clear.
I think that's unfortunately a highly intellectual word that's inaccessible in its true meaning to most of our population. I think the people who voted for our current ruler did not in fact understand the ways in which fascism was reemerging, and in fact that they were endorsing it, causing it to actualize. So I do think that we should start using the word ruler when we refer to our current office holder in the highest executive. Thanks.
I appreciate that observation, and I'll keep it in mind. Thank you. Thank you, caller. We got just a couple minutes left. If there's anyone else that wants to get in with a comment, an observation, 608-256-2001. Who should I have on the program? I'm always looking for new stimulating guests. What have people thought of some of the recent folks I've had on? David McNally, for instance, or who else? Who else? 256-2001. I'm trying to avoid dead air, folks, believe me. So if we don't have anyone else wanting to come in, I think we can do a wrap-up. I want to thank Jack for juggling and engineering today. I want to thank Sarah for helping to produce. And I want to thank you, our listeners. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you, or trying to speak with you, next week. Thanks, folks. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with an admission that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Yeah.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show...
When the boat left from Turkey, they did have a pilot who was a smuggler who knew how to motor, knew how to control this boat. And about halfway across, another boat came alongside, operated also by smugglers, and the pilot abandoned ship.
On October 28, 2015, the world witnessed the sinking of an overly crowded refugee ship in the Mediterranean Sea. Over the last decade, approximately 30,000 refugees in total have drowned. Award-winning journalist Jean Carstensen was there that day in October 2015, and she has stayed with the story ever since. She is the author of the book, A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. She'll join us to talk about it next. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Donald Trump has acknowledged that a period of difficult transition is inevitable as his trade policies continue to cause upheaval on international markets. Speaking during a cabinet meeting in the White House, Mr. Trump insisted that investors were happy. There have been further falls on Wall Street, with the Dow Jones dropping by about 4%. Our North America correspondent, John Sudworth, reports.
It's been another day of turmoil on the US markets as traders try to make sense of the US president's rapidly changing policies. The relief that followed his 90-day pause of the more